Good morning, everybody. It's time to call the meeting to order. Where's Stephanie? Oh, you're Stephanie. Shonda, would you call the meeting to order, please?
Yes. William Gingold.
Here.
David Happ.
Here.
Cheryl Henley Maxwell.
Here.
Gail Kennedy. Deb Roosh.
Here.
Thank you.
Couple of new faces. So I'd like to introduce everybody to Dr. Bill Gingold and Dr. Gail Kennedy and welcome them to the board. I'm excited. They both have a wealth of experience in the world of DD. So would both of you like to just say a little bit more about yourselves?
So I'm Gail Kennedy. And I am a currently retired pediatric neurologist. I retired about 18 months ago and was in the community at Carl, working in that capacity for a little over 20 years. And previous to that was working out in Billings, Montana. So my experience with children with developmental disabilities and families is mainly in the younger ages and mainly as both a physician and as much as I could in that role as an advocate for families and children. So that's a little bit about my background and experience.
Bill Gingold, I'm a retired psychologist, gerontologist from family medicine at the University of Illinois. I'm glad to be here.
Agenda. I'd like to make a motion to approve it as presented.
Second.
Comments? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? It's approved. Citizen input, public participation.
My name is Linda Tortorelli. I am the coordinator of the autism program at the university. So I have some exciting news. An organization, ABA Company, is coming to town, definitely. We had a meeting late into the night last night. It's called The Place for Children with Autism. They will be opening at Lincoln Square Mall officially. The first week in September, so that whatever Tuesday is after Labor Day. The model that they have, they're coming down from Chicago, is a full-day preschool model. It's not called a school. It's called a clinic. It can't officially be a school without all the school rules and regs. But they've overcome the hurdle of getting in network with Health Alliance. So it is insurance-based, so there's no cost to the family. The other exciting thing about their model is that they've been working with families who do not have insurance or have Medicaid to get them into the Affordable Care Act. So you can only do that during open enrollment period, so that won't be until whatever that is, December. But they have done that repeatedly, and they are very philanthropic, have a lot of investors, and so they're really helping these families meet the cost of that insurance, so with the co-pays and deductibles. Don't ask me exactly how. We've had some conversations. That's not my forte. I'll let them answer any questions to be official about how they're getting through that and around that. But they're really, up in Chicago, they're like in the Pilsen neighborhood. They're really trying to be in underserved neighborhoods up there to meet this sort of philanthropic bent. What I really appreciate about this organization is that they are holding themselves to a very high standard. In the field of ABA, applied behavior analysis, it's not always the best delivery. There's a lot of issues with the way services have been delivered, with high turnover, quality, fidelity of way therapy is being delivered. They have really built into their model, have addressed those issues. Not that glitches don't happen, But they have, if anybody speaks ABA language, they have a full-time board-certified behavior analyst, BCBA, that is on the floor, on site, every day. In a home model, you don't have that. You have the BCBA visiting your home maybe once a week, if you're lucky, and then the therapy is being done by behavior therapists. Our organizations, the other ones here in town, do not require their line therapists to be registered behavior technicians. The industry is moving in that direction. Pretty soon, insurance companies aren't going to reimburse if you're not certified as an RBT, but it's not required at the moment. But they require all their behavior therapists to be registered behavior technicians. So I won't go into all the details of how they're trying to ensure the quality of service, but I am impressed at this point. Quite a few of the families went up to visit their locations in Chicago to see for themselves kind of what this looks like. So I'm excited about it. There's room for more children right now. 6 and under are the ages that they're serving. They have to have an autism diagnosis because of the insurance thing, as far as I understand right now. What else can I tell you? Lincoln Square Mall, they'll be open. Their first space is going to be only about 2,000 square feet, but by October they're being promised their whole square footage, which is about 5,500 square feet. They'll have a playground outside that's secured. So I think it's a good location. They really are anxious to have this relationship with the university. They would really like to have their programs evaluated. There's a tiny BCBA program embedded in special education. We'd really like to see that grow. And then in my internship program, all of our interns go through the RBT program to try and expose them to the field of ABA. So we're going to be working with them on that. Just to be fair to the other organizations here that I've also helped support and get started, there's Skill Sprouts is operating. They now have a clinic here in town, and then Total Spectrum, which only does in-home. So I think this is a nice complement to what we have, a full-day ABA opportunity for 6 and unders. We have Skill Sprouts that does in-home and has a center base for all ages, and Total Spectrum that just does in-home. And I will say, out of those, I feel like Total Spectrum, well, all of them serve, well, the Place for Children with Autism only serves 6 and under. The other two say they serve all ages. I think they're doing a nice job, where Total Spectrum, I think, really does a nice job with older individuals that have really challenging behaviors still. They're not afraid of those behaviors. And while Skill Sprouts certainly will take them as well, I think that their niche right now with their therapists are, doing well with, and they're also offering half-day programs, Total Spectrum. So I'm seeing some families choosing to send their kids, no matter what their elementary school age is, half-day to Skill Sprouts and half-day with their school. So we're giving families more options. We're giving kids more access to ABA services. I can't tell you the amount of kids that are finally getting toilet trained, where our schools really haven't been able to tackle that. So it's good movement. So that's my short update on ABA services in Champaign. So,
yay.
Sure, yeah, any questions? I was so dead tired last night when I went home. They gave me a whole packet, and I just dumped them at my door. So it's called The Place for Children with Autism. I'd be happy to send everybody an email. Who's our note taker? Let me put that in the notes, or I'll send it off to you directly. Great. I'd be happy to talk to you directly, Patty, and connect you to the people as well. Yeah, so the time to register is now. I think they have 4 families that are committed. They're coming regardless. 6 is the magic number to make it even financially viable, but they're going to get started with who they have, and they can take up to 12 with 1 BCBA, which is what they have. So we've got plenty of room, for this first batch of kiddos to get through. It's year-round. Right now, they're very responsive, I think, to the folks up north as well. And so parents were asking about extended day, and they do extended day to the best of their ability, with 4 kids and staff. But they really try. So the other thing that works for them is it's all full-time staff with full-time benefits at good wages. So they really are addressing this, trying to make everybody be cohesive and stay and kind of be a family. So they're in Chicago, the way they do it, if the therapists are willing to shift their hours, then they offer extra hours into the evening. We have a family that wants to start at 6:30 in the morning, like, well, if we could find a therapist that's, like, because each child also has their individual therapist. But they flip them in the afternoon so that they're not regimented to one. You know what I mean? So there's a lot to this, but they're willing to attempt to work it between the families and the therapists that they have that can provide that amount of time. So, yeah, happy to
take it. I just want to remind everyone, because we're in a different room, just make sure you push the on button for your mic anytime you want to speak.
Any more citizen input? I just have one comment today. I just recently learned that Melissa Wright, and I don't know Melissa Wright, she has a long history with the Division of Developmental Disabilities. I heard she's back from Florida, and I was very excited to hear that because she seems to be not afraid to voice her opinions about what a mess our state is in the development and administration of developmental disability services. I read that she really truly believes that services are to fit the individual versus the individual fit the allocated services. And so it was really nice to hear that she's here to tackle some of the issues that we have. And then I read that she's leaving in January. So that was so deflating to me. I guess she has an ARC webinar, an hour-long ARC webinar. That should be pretty easy to access, so I would encourage you all to listen to what she has to say, and if you at all believe she has something worthwhile in her comments, just to encourage either her to continue on as director or encourage people at the state level to try to find somebody who thinks like she thinks to continue on. And that's all I really had to say. We have two sets of minutes. The first one is from our meeting on May 23rd, our big allocation meeting. And the second is from June 27th, which was not an official meeting because we did not have a quorum. But as I understand it, we still need to go ahead and individually approve the minutes from both meetings, right?
I'm trusting that our parliamentary expert put them in the board packet.
Okay.
For that reason.
Okay. So I'd like to make a motion to approve the minutes of the May 23rd, 2018 meeting as presented in the packet. All in favor? Opposed? Okay. You're up.
I'll make the motion we approve.
Okay, so the minutes are approved as presented in the packet. On pages 15 through 18, a copy of the claims report is included. Action is requested. Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the financial information is approved as presented in the packet.
Here comes the big item.
Number 9, new business A, election of officers. We need a motion. Well, we have to elect a president and a secretary again this year. I believe that the motion is that we is to nominate. Is that correct?
Yes, I think you can do this one person at a time or a slate.
Or
but
a slate.
Someone would move to nominate a slate of officers or one officer at a time.
Not really.
I feel so happy to have a full board. I'm just delighted about all of you.
It's been kind of a fast-moving, busy month, and basically, we have two brand new board members here who probably don't want to really jump in and be president this year. Although I would just love that if they were comfortable in that role.
I am definitely moving that you continue on.
That's what I thought was good. That's where I thought we were going with this. So, and I think our secretary might be willing to continue.
Second.
So we're going to do one at a time or both?
We might as well do a slate. Okay. Is there a discussion? Okay. So I guess all in favor of continuing with me, Deborah Rouge, as president for one more year, and David Happ as secretary. That's the motion. I'm going to say all in favor. This is not a financial expenditure, so it's just a voice vote. All in favor, again?
Aye.
Opposed? Congratulations, David.
So before you relax, are you ready for your first wonky fact of the day? You can choose to elect other officers as
hush.
The required our president and secretary. Other than that, it's just whatever you want to do. So you're satisfied.
It doesn't seem to be a whole lot of stuff.
Yes, and for more officers.
More officers.
Got it.
Okay, under item B, we have a draft budget. Which is on pages 20 through 27. And this is the second month that this has been included. So there's been plenty of time to look at it. I am pretty happy with the way it's presented, but maybe we need to talk about that a little more. We should probably make a motion.
I move to approve the CCDDB budget with anticipated. Nope, I didn't say that right, but you know what I'm saying.
Discussion. I understand that we will have changes to this budget. There's no way to even approve a budget that's not going to have some changes before September at the earliest, as I understand it. Right, Linda, do you want to discuss that a little bit more?
This is probably the most complicated part or the most unclear part of the work that we do is the relationship between this and the county, Champaign County. So we'll have, in statute, there's nothing about this, so we just kind of have a practice of working with the county. The county auditor handles all of our accounting, so they do an independent audit of our funds as part of that, and so whatever we do is expected to meet the same standards of all the other funds that they manage. So part of what we're doing is organizing the information in a way that works well for the auditor. And then the other part is, you know, presenting just sort of the big picture to the county of what's happening. The county will probably give us different revenue projections, but so we'll get a different revenue projection very likely in September. But it also might change in November, and then the county board might change it again. So you're going to see this again at some point, whether you see it again in September, October, November, or December. It'll be somewhat changed, and it might be small. There's also this sticky issue of hospital property tax, which gets deposited and then it gets pulled out. So it's not included at all in these descriptions because we do not have authority to use it. So it might pop in the next version that you see, but it'll be noted that we can't spend it. So until the appeal is complete.
Mental health board portion of I think they're our parent organization, is that correct?
Well,
but anyway, I'm wondering why that particular budget is projected to be more than the projected revenue from 2018. It's more than $200,000 more that they've got for their budget. Is there, yeah,
revenue?
I was just curious as to how you would project to spend more, or that you'd project more revenue than is projected in the 2018 revenue.
For 19?
Yeah, so there.
It's a large
More money coming in.
You're right. It's a large increase. I think the increase is, at this point. I'm sorry, it's been a while since I worked with the numbers, but it's over 4%.
Okay.
So you're right. It is a large increase, and it's unusual. The mental health board tends to have larger increases than the DD board just because of the way they were initially capped. So so their growth can be much bigger, or it can. This year, I think the growth is the same. Yeah, it's growth. It's, yeah.
Okay.
It is, yeah. And it's also, there's also growth in the community, so it's both of those things. You're right. So it is an over 4% increase to both boards. So that is a good observation, because usually it's not that big. So. And then with that hospital tax, it's almost 8%. But for example, well, this year it would have been an 8% increase if we did get to spend it. And anyway, so that's a peculiarity I probably shouldn't have even mentioned. But it's just to say that there are some basic things that will change, in whether it's September or October or November. And then there are some little things that are also going to change, like the estimates of personnel costs will also change because of health insurance first. I think the other insurance amounts are also estimates. These are very small compared to other expenditures in this budget, so they won't change it very much, but you'll have to see it again anyway. And I already have some changes that I know I need to make. But I think it's really important for you all to have a look at these budgets before the county board does, if possible. And then, you know, when we get changes from county administration or the auditor or county board, I'll show you those too. So your comment about the relationship to the mental health board is actually really important. They're not really the parent, but their budget shows all of the administrative expenses, and yours only shows a total of that adjusted by a couple of contracts that you don't participate in, and then you're paying 42.15% of that total. So it's a little bit odd, but that's the practice for many years, and it's based on time studies that were done at 2 points in time. So that's something written into the intergovernmental agreement between the two boards, but it could change. We could do the accounting in different ways. So it's just something, you know, at the moment, it's something you've chosen. It's not mandated in any way. That's a share of the administrative expenses, and of a subset of the administrative expenses.
If you'd like some time, I can give you a history of when it was started, how it happened, and it was originally based upon revenues that was originally of the two revenues they brought in. That's how the original assessment was. After the first year, the mental health board provided the administrative services for nothing, so we could get it going. And then the next few years, it was based upon the total revenues that each brought in. So if it was $3 million on one and 3.5 on the other percent was, and then then about halfway through this, then they went to the based upon a time study that was done. So.
given the differences in the rates of growth of the two funds, that first approach might be appropriate at some point to go back to a revenue-based approach.
Call for the question.
You did the motion, okay.
So it's just this
voice vote. And we have two motions on this DNMO page here, so we have to move on to the second one. Okay. Chandra, would you?
William Gingold. David Happ. Cheryl Henley Maxwell.
Yes.
Gail Kennedy. Deb Roush.
Yes. So the motion to approve the attached budget is approved as presented. On this, as part of this D-memo, we also have a secondary motion to consider. So I'll just make the motion to approve the attached 2019 SILA fund budget with anticipated revenue of $118,100 and expenditures of $94,194. Payment to this fund is consistent with the terms of the intergovernmental agreement between the CCDDB and the CCMHB.
Second.
Discussion?
It might be good.
Okay. This one also, I'm pretty sure you'll see this one again, but for a different reason, and that is that we have. So this is an agreement between the two boards to equally fund the purchase and maintenance of up to 4 small group homes. We've purchased 2 because the renovations to make one as accessible as possible took a lot longer and were more expensive. And then at some point, we found a third house, but by then we needed to go back to the bank's board to get approval because the note it was expired, so or whatever the approval of the loan had expired, so we need to go back to them. So I came to our boards first, and there was a consensus that, you know, given how difficult it is to find direct support staff in this community, that jumping ahead with a third home might result in an empty house. And so maybe okay just to watch this fund for a while. So you always have the option to purchase 1 or 2 more homes if there's enough money left and if we go back to PNC in order to do that. In the meantime, the attorney who developed these agreements for us in the beginning passed away. So to get to really move forward on that, I need to find someone else, maybe in his office. And as a result, we went back to the original agreements, the auditor's office, and we looked at the original agreements and discovered that we maybe do need to watch out for liabilities. Like if there's damage to the house, we need to be prepared. So I will probably go back to this budget and expend a little bit more. You can see that it's a surplus budget. It doesn't need to be. It's just that we didn't have anticipated expenses that matched the revenue. But now it looks like, you know, I've got some expert advice that maybe go ahead and plan first. Yeah, so you'll probably see this one again, but it's never, you know, it's just this is all about maybe these things will happen. Maybe we'll be interested in purchasing another home at some point. But,
yeah. Does the board basically own the property?
The borrower is the mental health board because the DD board doesn't have authority within statute to borrow, but they do have authority to own. So once the note is paid, the boards will equally own the houses.
I mean, pardon me, Chandra?
David Happ. William Gingold. Cheryl Henley Maxwell. Gail Kennedy. Deb Roush.
Yes.
Passed.
Okay, moving on to item C, board direction. This is an item that we added a few months ago because we've had board members who needed to voice opinions, ideas, and provide input earlier on in the meeting. And it seemed like since we added this, we haven't needed it. But
we might have added it at the wrong time of the year.
Probably.
Because this is a great time to start some visioning because we're going to be developing another three-year plan and a new set of funding priorities. So I think, you know, we might use it this time, we might use it in September, might use it in October, right? It seems, I don't know.
I'm not suggesting we do away with it at this point. It's just that every month I say board direction and nobody says anything, so.
Oh, I see. You all have big ideas.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be one of those things that we use it occasionally as issues arise, yeah.
Is there a possibility of getting input from the service providers in terms of ideas for the board? How did we do that?
They have a place in the agenda on a regular basis. So first of all, they have a place in the agenda so they can talk to us during the meetings, but since that's not really very much time, they are certainly welcome to email comments and ideas, and I can forward those to the board, or we could include them in a board packet. Sometimes we take the you know, last year priority document and the previous three-year plan and share those out and ask for comments. But we don't have to do it at any particular time. We can, whenever you have comments.
Okay, moving on to item D. There's an alternative housing resource guide in your packets, beginning on page 28, going through 29, and we have Elizabeth Moscoso Anderson and Becca Obuchowski from Community Choices here today to do a presentation. Welcome.
Hello. I'm sorry, new microphones, intimidating. I'm Becca Obuchowski. I'm the director of Community Choices for any of our new board members.
I'm Elizabeth Moscoso Anderson. I was an Illinois Lend Fellow this previous year, and I'm an independent service coordinator here for Champaign County Regional Planning.
So I'll just talk a little bit about the background to this project that we worked together on. Community Choices and the members that have been part of the co-op have long really been interested in having additional options for people, sort of outside the traditional options that are provided for through state funding. You know, it's a group of people who are often saying, you know, something about this isn't quite right, and I think that we'd like to create an option that's really specific to myself or to my family member, and Community Choices has really made an effort to try to support those families and those individuals to create the options that are going to be the best fit for them. So back in the early days of the organization, when Jen Knapp was still here, some of the co-op members, as well as Jen, they participated in some supportive housing and alternative housing training through CIF, Center for Independent Futures, up in Evanston, Illinois, who have been leaders in the state of creating some of these alternative housing options for people, and also in training families and organizations to create those sort of opportunities. So they had the benefit of some training there, also just a lot of sort of collaboration between family members and with some of the staff at the organization in years past. So one of the things that we wanted to make sure was that, you know, as some of these opportunities, as families built them and as they sort of ebbed and flowed in their success and challenges and journey, we wanted to make sure that we were able to sort of capture some of those stories and really sort of create the next next piece of some of the housing guides that that Jen and CIF had put together to support families and say, you can take these tools and these ideas and this process and really apply it to your own life. And so we wanted to be able to sort of tell those stories as a resource for families in our community to say, this is possible. Not only is this possible, there's people here that you could potentially call up and ask questions to if an opportunity or a situation like this seems like it might be right for you. So that was when I was able to collaborate with Elizabeth here, who obviously has a lot of experience with families in this community and with what some of the service options and housing options are for people, as well as sort of the power behind the LEND program at the U of I, and sort of work on this this guide. So I'll let her kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so just to give some background on the LEND program, it's the Illinois Leadership Education and Neurodevelopmental and Related Disabilities program. It's housed at the University of Illinois in Chicago, but there's a local cohort here in Champaign. It's about 30 people. It's a year-long graduate-level interdisciplinary training that's really designed to improve the health and well-being of individuals with disabilities. And so a part of that, I participated as a social work graduate student, but there were, you know, any related or directly related field was able to participate. So we had graduate students that were in special education, physical and occupational therapy, speech path, and, you know, we had pediatricians as well. So this training is focused on the policy, advocacy, research, and clinical skills, which are necessary to affect positive change on all levels, from individual to larger systems. So as many PhD students would just focus on their dissertation research for this program, but I knew as an independent service coordinator here in Champaign County that there were many opportunities to participate on a leadership project and to kind of create something that would be helpful for our community. And so I reached out to Becca, and we talked about this alternative housing guide, and so that's what it became. We decided I would create a supportive housing resource guide for individuals and their families to develop and envision possible alternative housing options within Champaign County. And so the process that we did, we first identified families within Community Choices who had created these successful or had created some alternative housing situations. And the interview consisted, I'll let Becca talk about that in a little bit. There were some parts of it that we focused on that would be helpful for other families to learn about. And then I took all that information from those interviews and created some case studies on how they were able to map out the services that they had and how they obtained them. And then created the guidebook that you have in your packet with the template of if and then. So that if, it, for example, if you have waiver funding or if you have home-based support funding, then these are some of the services that you would be able to use with that funding. And that's something that I have to explain in my role quite frequently and have this conversation of, okay, if you're going to use home-based support, how can we support you living in your home independently, or how can we support you in your family's home? Or even with group homes, there's so many instances in which people are just not appropriately suited because their level of independence is just much more. So I'll let Becca talk about the interview.
We worked together to kind of, you know, we had a few ideas about what, you know, what the guide should be, and kind of honed that with Elizabeth. And, you know, some of the ideas that she had in the LEND program. And then in terms of the interview questions, you know, I had sort of a sense of the information that I wanted to kind of get from families and some of the information that I felt like would be helpful for other families down the road. And so we really broke it down into about one section, and I won't read all the questions to you. But basically, I think what we wanted to start with was, where did families start? Where were you when you decided that, you know, you really wanted to move forward with creating, you know, some sort of alternative housing option for your family member? So just kind of to kind of get a sense of where people were at, where did they, you know, you have to meet people where they're at, and thinking about this as something that future families who are maybe early on in this process might be looking at, I wanted to make sure that we sort of captured a little bit of the mindset of those families, where they were when they started too, because I think that that can be a really relatable thing. Like, oh, I didn't know how this was going to work when I got started either, and that might be where you were at. So I think it's really important to kind of respect where people are at in that process. So that's where we started. And then sort of as you know, moving forward in that sort of process or timeline, as you're trying to think about what sort of housing option might be possible, there's a matrix with which Elizabeth will kind of show in a minute, but really trying to think about it in terms of, like, there's the physical housing aspect of it, and that can be really important to somebody being successful and being independent in their own home. So trying to envision, like, okay, what sort of physical environment is really going to work for somebody, you know, and that might be because of just, you know, accommodations within the household, or it might just be because, you know, they really need sort of a small, quiet, tucked away place, or they really need it to be in a particular part of the community, or they really like to be around lots of people. So kind of getting a sense of what factors there were going to be important. And then, you know, the alternative side of supportive housing is, of course, not just the physical environment, but the support. And so what sort of support is going to be necessary for this person to be able to live the full life in the community that they're looking for? You know, and some of that has to do with, okay, like, you know, kind of how much support are you as a family member providing right now? And what do you think might be possible in the future? And then, you know, kind of, did that change? Was that really accurate? Was there actually, you know, as you got farther along on this process, did you find that maybe more or less support was necessary? And I think that for a lot of people, you know, your expectations about what's going to be necessary are probably not always going to be accurate, right? Because life changes and different variables are there. So then we really wanted to kind of get a sense of what sort of support the person, you know, at least starting out, was going to be kind of part of that plan. And then also kind of, how would you create backup systems and how are you going to sort of fund that sort of support? And, you know, some people had the opportunity, as Elizabeth said, to use home-based support funding. Other people, you know, set it up through other means. So kind of just looking into that part of it. And then finally, we really wanted to get a sense of, you know, these were families that had kind of, they created these opportunities for themselves or their family members. So we really wanted to talk about sort of what the outcomes were. And in some instances, the outcomes were great and things were really super successful. Other times, there was really bumps along the road. And I think that that's another really important thing to be able to communicate to other people, that it's not always going to go like you expect. And you know, the things that you're worried about and fear might come to pass, and other things that you didn't expect might be positive outcomes or possibly not. So just being able to share a little bit of that information in terms of the kind of what that history looked like for each person.
So something that I found from the IDEP Housing Resource Guide, which I would also recommend if you're interested in this topic at all. This was a statewide kind of collaboration. Jen Knapp also contributed to it. They did a really nice job kind of guiding families through the process of envisioning how they would like these systems to look like for themselves. So something that was really great from this was the community living options matrix, which really concisely describes or identifies what types of housing and supports are even available. When you start to envision this process, it is super overwhelming, and it's very helpful to have this table that kind of describes, you know, the type of housing and how it can be owned and how it can be funded, as well as the types of services and if you are able to get a service provider, if you can do that as a family, or how service is even funded. So something that would be really useful when a family is starting to talk about this is to, when they're developing and planning their housing, to circle preferred choices and cross out anything that they would say is undesired, and to see where overlap exists within the group. So what was really great about the families that we were able to identify in community choices is that the 5 case studies that I created were of different living situations. So there were rooms in a home that individuals were able to rent individual rooms. There was an apartment that the individual was able to utilize Section 8 housing voucher for. There was an individual that lived in a condominium. There was a duplex, and there was a single level house. So we had a nice kind of, what is the word that I want? Yeah, yeah, we had a nice spectrum of options to talk about. And of all of the families, they all reported successful outcomes and unexpected challenges and benefits. But some of the things that I thought were kind of the most focused on was that a lot of the parents had mentioned that they wanted to plan with for their child with the focus that if they're not here, if the parent wasn't here, then what would the child need? And how can they put those things into place for them? So trying to, like Becca had mentioned before, creating those backup systems and having those additional supports, whether that be family or friends or agencies in town that they would be able to rely on if they were not there. And also just thinking not too far in the future, but thinking in more in terms of 3 to 5 year chunks. I think the most important part of all of it was that a lot of the families stress that you can't expect the process to be linear. It's going to take a lot of attempts to make something successful for the child, and so it needs to be tailored to the resident's needs, and you might not always get that the first time. And even a lot of the families, too, mentioned that it's really great to be able to connect with other families in similar situations. Like, that was something that they all relied on and had mentioned that was really helpful to them. And then one thing that was also made clear was that alternative housing can definitely be affordable and not to let cost deter other families that were interested. So that was kind of, those are the results that we found and created the guide, and there's definitely more in that. Moving forward.
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously this was a snapshot of sort of 5 different case studies or examples of what alternative housing can look like in our community. There's other families that we weren't able to connect with, you know, as part of this project, and our plans are really still to spend some time talking to them and continue to kind of get that information from people and tell those stories so that it can potentially help other families in our community. Or whoever else is sort of looking into this. I think we really wanted it to be just a resource to people and something that, you know, if people come to us and are interested in other options for themselves or for their family members, to be able to kind of be like, you know, here is actually like a physical thing that you can look through and get some ideas that's kind of taken from the like, here's a step-by-step process. And really applied to, like, and here's what people actually did with it. And, you know, it's obviously never going to be a one-to-one correspondence, but that there could be some really useful resources and ideas and just a little affirmation that their thinking and their process, you know, that there's people that have shared those experiences that they can kind of look to for support and ideas. So we were really excited to be able to create it and looking forward to continuing to add to it.
So I would like to thank Community Choices for the opportunity to create this guide and also to the members who participated in the development of it so that future families and co-op members are able to have access to it. Their input was invaluable in the creation of it. This work was also further supported by the Illinois Lend Program. And we are happy to take questions. Yeah.
They varied in ages. Everybody that we work with is over the age of 18. So I think it probably ranged from 20s, mid to early 20s, up through, you know, 30s, 40s. One of the examples in the guide is a house that Community Choices has supported that people rent. It's like a 4-bedroom house, and they kind of share the space. And I think that the people who live there, they vary. I think the oldest one is probably closer to 40. I don't know that there was anybody that was a whole lot older than that. Older than 40. Yeah.
I would say that the majority of the families are the residents were in their 20s.
Yeah.
So they were not just starting out, but they were earlier on in their process of planning. So they may not have had quite as many long-term supports put in place, and they were still kind of tweaking the model in which they were trying to set up the house.
But I think talking to some of the families who have set up sort of housing situations for people that have been a little bit farther on, we actually weren't able to talk to all of them for this guide. And so that is, I think that's a really good point to think about talking to folks who, you know, making a point to get some information from people who are kind of a little bit farther along in their life process, and their families are a little bit farther on in their life process, to see how those supports have changed and evolved over time.
And I think, too, this guide kind of serves as the just the beginning, right? So there's more families that will hopefully and do currently exist that have alternative housing arrangements, and if Community Choices was able to eventually add more to it and have some additional case studies, I think that would be so great for this community. Like, so many people would just, I think this would be so helpful for so many families, even just to start planning and to see it's possible. A lot of families, I don't think, do.
Very interested in your housing and support matrix. Were the families sufficiently knowledgeable to actually cross out items or include items in this?
You know, I don't know that the families that I interviewed had access to this matrix. I don't know if it had existed when they started to arrange it. I think that it would be really helpful to sit down with someone that would be able to explain much of it. I think that when you get into the area of service providers and what types of supports are available in the community, definitely, I think some families would need direction in that, or even utilizing some non-traditional funding sources to fund the home. The family that had the housing, the Section 8 voucher, for example, I think that's a hard thing to access, and most people don't know how. So that was a great thing to put in too.
I'm not positive that this matrix as it is right now was existed for a lot of the families when they were starting out. I think that this was created as part of the guide that Jen Knapp worked on with CIF. Kind of, it all sort of evolved together. Some tools like this are things that we do sort of embed into our community living program and our community transitional support program, as we're kind of meeting with people and getting a sense of what they're looking for in terms of support and moving out of the family home. So I think it is a really helpful resource, and I think looking at it, sort of looking back, it was really helpful for us to be able to kind of conceptualize like what we wanted this guide to look at, and certainly going forward, you know, as we're working with folks, using that kind of tool to kind of create that framework for thinking about things. Like, those things are super helpful for me, I know, and it can be kind of help to put all of your racing thoughts into order. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was really a blend of different things. So the individual who had Section 8 funding, he also had home-based support. So he was able to pay for some of that support side through home-based. We had people, definitely people who didn't have any state funding. I think that was probably, especially as things were starting out, I think that was probably more the pattern. Other people, you know, maybe got funding somewhere along the line for usually home-based you know, we didn't have anybody who used intermittent SILA or any of those sorts of funding streams. But home base was a big one on the support side. In terms of other sort of housing costs, most of the housing was purchased by the families, except for the example of the individual who got Section 8 and the four-bedroom house, which was actually, like, purchased by a member of the co-op, but folks that own a lot of property and rent that out, so they were able to kind of create some options there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Five people have major medical issues or medication administration type things that had to be taken into consideration in the housing situation?
Definitely mental health. So medication administration and management was just definitely something that the families would continue to support, or they would hire help to do that. I don't know that any had any, I guess when you say major medical.
You answered my question. I just want to make sure that was one of the considerations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think for different families that we have worked with, maybe some of whom we talked through for this project and some other ones, I think that there's different ways that folks handle that. And families do tend to be involved, but sort of working with support workers to create some good backup systems for that is something that we've had some success with. We didn't work with anybody who needed regular nursing care, for example. And if that was the consideration, I think there might be some additional sort of columns on that matrix that you might have to think about, but that could be an option for people too.
So what some resources that are just one other resource that I really wanted to point out was this other guide that I had mentioned from the Center for Independent Futures, the Alternative Housing Options for Individuals with Disabilities, a guide for forming and implementing community partnerships. And that's that guide that Jen Knapp had also contributed to. It's a really great guide if you know a family that's looking into envisioning and starting that process of planning. That's a perfect starting point. And our guide is really kind of the application of that. And so how did those families then move forward, and what does that look like in practice? And then when I've done this for other places, I've also mentioned the PUNS list. So families are eligible to reach out for potential waiver funding as well for additional support. Mm-hmm.
I'd love to talk to you about that.
Information, but that probably hasn't happened yet. How to anticipate supporting what they want to do.
Yeah, I think that is a really important conversation to have, and I think that little bug that was flying around like straight down my throat. No problem, guys. but yes. Yeah. and I think that our two perspectives I think probably would really be a nice complement to each other in thinking about how families can kind of handle that, and how individuals and organizations too. So good point. Take some water.
Becca, I noticed when I read through the guide that nobody's using technology yet to increase independence or to help the families connect with individuals. We will be building a smart home, and we're going to be doing research on the human factors side as well as the development of
really
additional
exciting
technology. And so as our results come out, we're actually focusing on the aging population, but we have a subtext of individuals with disabilities as well. So I would guess that you'd want to, once we get that up and running, see what we're doing, see how technology is being tried out, so that you can carry that kind of information forward to families in the community,
too. Yeah, I would love that. I mean, I think that that's something when I've sort of just talked with families who are kind of thinking about how to move forward, thinking about how technology can kind of fit into this is something that they really are wondering about and looking to explore more. And honestly, I sometimes am like, I don't know.
Right.
So, yeah, those resources.
And there's a lot of generally available technology. The issue is, how do you train people? How will people accept it, and how will they use it? And so that's one of the biggest functions that we have, is looking at that technology and the human factors side of it.
Yeah, that's really exciting. That's very exciting news. I'd love to know more about that. I think there was one family, and I think they probably got it started a little bit after we interviewed them, they got like an Amazon Alexa. Had that already started?
Yeah.
It was either really early on in the process. And so that is one kind of technological piece that people have started, you know, exploring. But I'm sure there's more and better options.
So it can intersect with interfaces too. So like if people leave their stoves on.
Oh, wow!
Wow.
Cool. That's wonderful.
Dr. Maxwell, our state the state of Illinois, by the way, is finally being receptive to this also and including it in part of their discussions with the waiver so it can be used more and having discussions with other states that are already doing that. And so as part of our state association, I'm starting work pretty actively to try to pursue that more. So I hope to have conversations with you on that as we go forward.
We actually connect you with our program coordinator.
Yeah. Okay, they're not quite there, but it's getting close, so I'll be in contact with you when that happens. Thank you.
I just don't want to forget to get back to something that you touched on about the state's regulations around independent living. Yeah, just later in my comments, I don't want to forget. So there's a little bit of background for these letters. There are two letters here to you from providers, but they're here for different reasons. The first one is from the Illinois Association of Microboards and Cooperatives. It's page 60. And that we actually asked this provider to write this letter to us because she started to struggle with some of our requirements. Our requirements compared to the level of funding that she was receiving, and had some observations for us that I thought were really important and that might actually shape, if we change our audit policy or if we change our funding guidelines, we might want to take some of these things into consideration. And further, I looked at the whole set of funded agencies and found kind of a danger zone where like total revenue is not necessarily enough to support some of the infrastructure that, and it might be different types of infrastructure that agencies need to continue in the current environment, let alone the coming environment, which I will talk to you about in my comments later. But this was very straightforward. Our reporting requirements were too much for a small agency. So if we value the contributions that small local organizations can make to local problems, then we need to make some adjustments in recognition of their total revenue and their staff capacity. We have an indirect cost limit of 20%, and then we require some discussion about everything that's in the indirect cost and what it means to the program. So that might be another area where we have to find some flexibility or through our administrative budget, support shared infrastructure for some of the agencies. These are all ideas that other communities across the country are grappling with as they lose provider capacity. I think Illinois is way ahead in that, in the loss of capacity, and not so far ahead in creative ways to bring it back. So that letter is very important for that reason. The second letter is just an update from the provider of the residential services in those two small group homes that you own. And it's just, we try to get updates from them every month, but it's usually just so much the same stuff, struggling with, you know, making sure we have enough staff and, you know, people are pretty much participating in the same types of programs from one month to the next. So this annual report at least kind of captures an overview and some, I think it has a little bit about staffing ratios, right? Did they do that this year? Oh, the staffing ratio and information is kind of interesting, and they didn't put that in this year, but it is one of the homes has a very low staffing ratio high. Actually, they both do, but for different reasons. One home serves people who have some physical disabilities as well, and then the other home has young men who sometimes they're still working it out with each other, so there need to be a lot of eyes on them. So it's really, you know, if you ever want an update besides what you see in the board packet, we can find out quite quickly what's going on, but it's just, we don't tend to include that because it doesn't change much from one month to the other. And because of the nature of that agreement, they don't do the same kind of reports to you that all these other service providers do, which are quarterly and then annual. So anyway, that's...
This first letter that you mentioned, what are you recommending to the board in terms of actions to adjust for the needs of those small organizations?
Well, we've spent a lot of time with some CPAs on this, and they have very different opinions about what we should do. One says, do not, so right now we have a limit. If the total of your grant from us is $20,000 or less, then you don't owe us an audit. If it's more than 20, then you owe us an audit with a whole bunch of requirements, additional requirements related to our reporting. So the cost of audits has gone up every year, and the funding has not kept pace with that. So one CPA is saying you absolutely need to see that much information about the financials. The other is saying it's ridiculous because you're going to be spending half of that grant, you know. So for right now, we have some, I see a bigger picture problem where there are some agencies where the total revenue is what we should be looking at. So I think what we're likely to do is simply raise that limit in our audit policy and say if you're receiving $30,000 or less from us, you're exempt from the audit policy. And then we need to look more deeply at what we're doing within the indirect costs. And that's in our funding guidelines too, which are, right now you're living under funding guidelines which were revised in 2009, so it's time to look at them anyway. So we keep working with these two CPAs and getting competing advice and trying to work out what we think is going to be best. We're not quite ready to make a recommendation, but we know things have to change for the next round of applications.
What is the state requirement from the Department of Revenue in terms of audits for not-for-profit organizations?
The state requirement, isn't it? The total agency revenue is
Yes, that checklist, and you're familiar with the checklist that right now we're asking independent auditors to verify that checklist for us. We could make that an internal process. It's all documents that you have that you could simply share with us. There are things like 990s and payroll tax evidence. There are two kinds of payroll tax evidence. It's just basic, like, show us that you're not on the brink of disaster kind of documentation, and that is really what we need to know. Is the agency, you know, going to get 2 months of funding and then fold? Right. So we have also a full-time financial manager on staff who has some ideas about how to do that. So we could.
Okay.
Letter does reference that over the past years their income was as high as $250,000. And through the state, there was no audit requirement. So that was at that threshold.
And so maybe our policy needs to, we don't, so I guess the answer is we don't have recommendations yet. We're still getting opinions on it, and I appreciate the input from the audience because this is actually about you. So. What we did with Vicky was we also have, you know, we allow for for 2,500 of the contract of our funding to be used toward an audit. We recognize that's not realistic anymore. That's like triple now for just a basic audit. So we gave an exception to Vicki so that she could get her audit done. So there's two ways we could do that, but I think we also don't want this fund to start being like for the sake of audit firms. So I think we need to really look at just, can we get the information in a less expensive way or a less onerous way for the agencies? And so I really appreciated her writing this. This was at our request. She is, as you can tell from the list here, no longer running a funded program from us because of this. And we also, another agency which was at the table for many, many years here was CTF Illinois. For different reasons, I think their revenue still is 90% from the state. So they have other types of difficulties. I think they have a over $6 million total revenue, $19 million. Okay, so their problems are very, very different. And their problems were not with our reporting requirements, but with surviving in the context of the state of doing business with the state of Illinois. So they were going to write us a letter, but the issues are so different. I think highlights from them would be transportation was an enormous problem for the people, and they were running a different type of day program, but running into the same problems that you've mentioned. So it's much bigger picture. So they were working on a letter to us as well. We'll probably see that in September, but real different.
Could we get a summary of the amount that's spent by agencies for independent audits?
I could ask them.
So you have a chance to take a look at the numbers.
So this is the happy part of the meeting, right?
Yes. We're moving next. Item F. Success is another agency information.
I can hear in from me yet. I just had a couple that I wanted to mention. Just piggybacking a little bit on our project. So starting in the fall, we had two self-advocates that actually applied to be part of the UIUC LEND Fellowship Program. And one of them was accepted into the program, so she's going to be a self-advocate member of that group and participating with the other graduate students and working on projects and volunteer leadership opportunities here in the community going forward in the next year. And she'll also be eligible for they provide a stipend to their participants and their fellows, and she will be eligible for that. So we're really extremely excited for her, and she's really looking forward to it. And the other individual who applied is also looking forward to applying again for the following year. So that, really excited to kind of hear what comes out of that, and I've been telling her how jealous I am that she gets to go. So I've asked her to come and tell me all the things she's learning. but that is really exciting. And I also just wanted to point out, so we had last week one of our members with a disability, she wrote an article for Smile Politely about these community conversations that we've been doing with stakeholders in the community about different issues that are important to self-advocates that we're working with. And so this one had to do with improving the interactions between people with disabilities and their healthcare providers, whether that be a doctor, dentist, counselor, et cetera. So they created this really lovely matrix of things that individuals with disability as patients can do, things providers can do, and things that support people can do. And so she wrote an article and kind of talked about what that process was like, and we've been really excited to be able to partner with Promise Healthcare and present that to some of their staff as well. As their board, and so she wrote an article up about it, and it's in Smile Politely, and she did an amazing job. You should all read it. And they're actually going to be publishing a few other articles written by some of our members with disabilities, so kind of keep your eye out for those. We're really excited.
Yeah. I just want to add, so the LEND program is actually, it's open to self-advocates, but it's also open to family advocates as well. So if someone that you know is interested, it is a program that is accessible to them too.
Okay, my name is Patty Walters, and I'm the Vice President of Clinical Services at DSC. So welcome, and it's nice to meet both of you. A couple of things that I wanted to mention. We have a new residential director who is, her name is Sarah Perry. She's been with DSC for many years in lots of different capacities. She started with us as a CODA. She was an assistant manager in our day training program many years ago and has just joined us as the residential director. Well, we're right now getting her to the point that she's full-time. I took some notes this morning, and I accidentally added a password, and it keeps timing out on me so that I'm not texting while I'm trying to talk. But another one is that we do have a new family development director that joined us in April. Felicia Guler was the person that you guys were all familiar with. She and her family relocated closer to home, which is Massachusetts. Her name is Nicole Seidman-Sikora. And she has some connections to the community through Choices and also not Rosecrans, but previously the Mental Health Center. And the funding has changed, so you probably won't see much of her. The children's program was previously funded by this board, but as of July 1st, has transferred to Mental Health Board. And it just did it again. Talk about technology. I could use that resource. I also have somebody present that's going to be really embarrassed that I'm going to bring this up, but in the News Gazette on Sunday, there was an article about the Hearts of Gold Award, and our Vicki Tolf received that recognition in May, so just wanted to give a little shout out to her. Everybody's worked well with her, so. And two other things, Philo Road. There's lots of rumors going around. I think you guys, some of you knew about it almost before we did. We've entered into a lease agreement, actually getting out from under a couple of buildings that has been part of a long-term plan to upgrade. We have been renting properties that we previously owned on the Bradley campus, and in September plan to move to 1808 Philo Road. Letters are going out to families today or tomorrow, just letting them know of the location and with finalizing lots of details. Transportation is the biggest challenge. We're kind of wading through, but it was a time for us to also really look at the support people are receiving and, does it make sense for everybody that was in that location to move to the new location, or are there other services that would best support them? So there's some communication going out about that this week, and we're excited about getting into that neighborhood. There's a lot of businesses in that area, so meeting the neighbors and connecting in kind of a different area of our community is going to be great for. Salt and Light is there. Planet Fitness is there. You know, we've got lots of activities that are happening with volunteer-supported employment and just physical fitness and recreation and stuff. So that's going to be happening. So it'll kind of serve as a hub. There'll be some people that'll go there daily, and there'll be some people that'll kind of be where they meet as they, kind of head out toward the community. But McKinley 3 building that is being replaced is one that, we did share, we discontinued work activities in that last October. So it is definitely more of a community focus and employment focus. So I wanted to mention that. And then there's one more thing. I can't believe I know my password. The last thing is on DSC's Facebook page, I just wanted to invite people to kind of take a look at that. And on Mondays, it's called Meet Me on Monday. There's some success stories that are shared there with either a person that's receiving services that has enjoyed either employment or community living or some type of advocacy or support. We're showcasing, like in June, it was we talked to four different dads for Father's Day, and in May it was all moms of people with, with adults with disabilities. And then we've also reached out and started including some of the DSPs that are in the workforce. So it's a really nice way to get to know not only what's going on, but some personal successes from people that that we're supporting. So I think that's all I had. So any questions about anything? Thank you.
Thank you, Becca and Patty. Hey, old business. Meeting schedules, as always, they're at the back of the book, pages 63 to 66. And I think our September meeting is in this room again. Or is it a later meeting?
No, you're right. We have
we had nice originally room, scheduled okay. for September 19th, and we would be in the big room, the meeting room on the other side of the building. But it's Yom Kippur, so we moved it to September 26th. So that's why we're in here again. But some of us are starting to really like this room, and we got the treatment this morning, didn't we? They came and helped us set it up. So nice. So it's not so bad.
All right, the acronyms, as always, are listed at the back, pages 67 to 74. That just keeps getting longer and longer, doesn't it?
This is a different one. We put
up to 7 pages now.
We decided, you've had one that was created by Ligas Family Advocacy Group. So we just decided to put, this is the one that Kim and I put together when you're going through the program summaries and considering applications for funding. This is the one you have. And it just seems like it's got everything that could come up while we're trying to learn to talk without acronyms, just in case you can you can see them.
Okay, did you have any mental health board input for us today, Lynn? They're meeting tonight, aren't they? No?
They don't. They're not going to meet in July. They finished this similar business in June. So they're not meeting until September. They're actually going to meet on September 12th and 26th, and one of those is a study session on the U of I Evaluation Capacity Project, which is, Kim is here, so maybe you get I'll say it and you tell me if I'm saying it wrong. For about 4 years, the U of I Psychology Department researchers have been helping the Mental Health Board agencies work on measuring and reporting on outcomes. And they work closely with 3 or 4 agencies each year. This is not required of the DDB agencies, and the resources are not completely available to the DDB-funded agencies, just partially available. So this year, in August, all the agencies are going to submit an outcomes report, but the DDB agencies do not have to complete every field because they don't have the information in order to do that. Just wanted to make sure. Kim sent an email to everyone to clarify that. We don't expect that level of, it's just not, you can't. But anyway. So the U of I evaluators will be giving a report on the work so far. We're hoping September 12th, but then whichever meeting they don't do will be a regular business meeting of the Mental Health Board.
So now it's time to segue right into your report.
Okay, and now I'm nervous because Kim is here. And Kiz, you can keep me on track. Okay, Kim and I went to conferences last week. She was there for the annual DD Summit of our National Association. I was there for 3 days of the National Association of Counties, and then our part of our DD Summit, and then 3 days of our National Association. So I have a stack of handwritten notes. I really tried to control. I didn't bring my laptop. I really wanted to learn to summarize and take as few notes as possible, but I am still typing them up. So I wanted to give them to you today and say, look, all these interesting topics, and you can click on the link for more information, but I'm not there yet because it's so much. So I thought instead I would share 3 important DD-related highlights from our sessions. The NACO stuff, there's a lot of material about early childhood programs, but we'll get back to that. The DD highlights were managed care organizations. Don't do it. If we could say anything to the state of Illinois, it's don't do it. Kim has a voluminous notes on what happened in Kansas and then in Iowa as they took their perfectly well-functioning Medicaid-funded DD system and dunked it into managed care and lost control of it. Disaster, right? Is train wreck? Right. So...
And so in our summit, there is a managed care representative sitting there. It's one of our corporate sponsors, and, you know, kind of, he has reports on various initiatives that they're working on, but they're not one of Illinois' health plans. It's United Healthcare and Optum. So, but they're, you know, the focus of that conversation ended up being like, all right, if we can't stop this train, then what can we say has to be in the plans? And then if to whatever extent we can get the ear of state of Illinois officials and recommend to them, these are the things that have to be in the plans before you take DD services into managed care. So we're working on that, kind of like the big picture warnings. So anyway, that was don't do it. Was the thing. The second is, you know, OIG nationally is doing reviews of each state to really look at the incident management process. It's clear that the incident management process around abuse and neglect and exploitation reports has harmed direct support staff, but also, and you probably know this from the Chicago Tribune, things are not going very well in community-based residential settings either. And so even though, you know, that seemed like, I think also there's a little bit of slant in the Tribune reporting, but it's true that there really do continue to be too many horrible incidents across the country. And so I don't know, they've completed reviews of three states. Illinois is not one of them. I don't know when they will come to Illinois to look at our processes, but the main recommendation that's popping out from that is that no matter the level of support and the level of restrictive setting people are in, the lifesaver is going to be some connection to the community, whether it's a part-time job in the community or a recreational activity where somebody else expects to see you every once in a while. So that if you disappear for 3 months, somebody's going to notice that, because there are such stories. So anyway, that was... And the presenter was crying by the end of that segment. It was so hard. Just, you know, he's the director of a state association of DD, and this happened in his community. And so, anyway, so I thought that recommendation was really a nice one for us, because I think everybody here is seeing that as a priority, that people have some community connection, and not family, but, like, just friends or associates. So... The third thing, and this is, we actually learned this yesterday from our committee. I'm just so happy about it, I have to share it. We shared it with one program director, but I think you all need to know that in Virginia, so in order for all of the different services to be manageable for families and individuals, there have to be case managers who are aware of all the resources and who work together to some extent to stay current on what's available. In Virginia, they require that all the mental health case managers are in the same office spaces as the DD case managers, so that the mental health case managers won't be afraid of people with DD. I just wanted all you DD case managers to know, good job. That's, I really love that. I would like to see that a requirement everywhere. So, anyway, those are my comments. I'll email all of my notes. Kim's are done.
Okay, we have staff reports from Chris Wilson, who's not here, on pages 75 and 76, and Barb Bresner, also not here today. If anybody wants to take a look, if anybody has any comments or questions, I would encourage you, especially about Chris's, to ask him or go through Lynn. Okay.
This is relatively new. Chris developed this with Mike Smith, who was a board member for 14 years until last month. And it's just a straightforward profit and loss statement. It's just shows you where we were at halfway through the year. So you can see, like, the funny line where we're 108% in the mental health board and then over 100%. Wait a minute. Yeah, 100%. In some other lines, that's because the agency contracts are allocated on a different cycle. So we have, oh no, that's not why. That's just because there's more than we expected in those two lines. But the two things that are not in here that you need to know about are that the DD board pays a share 42.15% throughout the year of budgeted expenses. And then when we get to the end of the year, we look at the actual expenses and you'll get money back because we're always under expended. So there'll be a little bit of an adjustment then. The other adjustment that doesn't get made till the end of the year is this transfer of gifts and donations. Some of the gifts and donations are related to the expo, and those are shared revenue to the DDB at the end of the year at 42.15%. So even if your budget looks a little bit under right now, that's okay because it will have those two adjustments, and there might even be some stuff that we haven't paid yet that is just a one-time payment for the year. So I'm not worried about being off of 50% right now, and I just wanted you all not to worry.
Board announcements, anything else? We are adjourned. Thank you all.
Everybody else was okay with starting at 7:30, except, this is important though, the county technology.